Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Scully?
Yes?
Marry me.
I love you and I like you.
I love you and I like you.
I love that woman. I love her more than sharks love blood.
I love you.
You don't.
Hello, I'm Tristan Riddell.
And I'm the girl.
And this is Nerd Nuptial episode 61, minus the bonus episode that we did last week.
That's right.
Which I'm super happy that we did because I'm still riding high on that season 5 House of Cards trailer.
Yeah, I'm excited. Can't come soon enough.
Now, okay, so today we're going to be talking about movie scores.
Yeah.
And this is something that was kind of spurred up from the nerd question of the day that we do on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and everything like that, which you guys should follow us. Go to facebook.com/thenerdparty or find us on Twitter @joinnerdparty, and we're the Nerd Party on Instagram. It's pretty easy to find us. And what we do is, as many days as possible, we do a nerd question. And I think it was Lee Hutchison who asked the question. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
And he said, he's like, what's your favorite movie score? And if we were talking movie soundtracks, that'd be very different.
Different, yeah.
Yeah. But scores, this is scores, this is composers, this is, bed tracks and everything like that in the movie, not basically the director's playlist that they grabbed from other artists.
We'll do that another time.
I think so. And I did this years ago when we first started, when the Nerd Party was just a show, not a network. I did this a long time ago, and I have all new stuff to talk about.
Things have changed since then?
Things have changed, and also I tried really hard it's so easy just to say, like, oh, yeah, this is my favorite, and this is my favorite, and this is my favorite. Like, I have the go-tos. Like, I could easily talk about The Fountain. Mm-hmm. I could easily talk about The Dark Knight, and everything. Like, I could easily talk about Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
But those have been talked about to death.
Sure.
So I'm going to try.
Because they have merit, but.
Yeah, exactly. Because those are my favorites.
Right.
Like those three that I just mentioned. Like if you ask me, what are your favorites? Those would probably be the three that I would mention.
Mm-hmm.
But I talk about them and you talk about them all the time. And so I'm going to try hard. I mean, you can go stereotypical if you want.
I might. Because I don't know. Some of them I feel like deserve to be mentioned. But we'll see.
Yeah, okay, well, that's the thing. Like, don't let me stop you. But before we get into that, one thing that we want to talk about is we just binge-watched the first 4 episodes, which are the only episodes available to date as of this recording, of The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
I was a little reluctant to watch this show. How about you?
I think just because we had an idea of the content that it was going to be rough, and it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're like, oh, are we in the mood for something so heavy? But I think that it was worth definitely. I had read some reviews that it was like one of the things you should definitely check out on TV this season. So we gave it a shot.
And we're doing a Hulu preview. Not preview, trial. We're doing a 30-day Hulu trial. And so I'm just kind of like, we have access to it, so why not watch it? And I don't know, maybe we'll pay for an extra couple of months in order to watch the rest of it. But yeah, so it's for those of you who don't know, The Handmaid's Tale, Handmaid's Tale? I think, right?
The Handmaid's Tale? Handmaid's Tale.
It's not Maiden? Oh my gosh, it's not.
I think so. I have to look it up.
It's The Handmaid's Tale? Oh my gosh.
Handmaids.
Handmaids. It is. It's The Handmaid's Tale. Oh my gosh. I've been calling it The Handmaid's Tale. Like, not that I've been talking about it a lot, but that's going to happen like a couple more times during this discussion, just so you know. I'm sure some of you were just like screaming at the at your MP3 players and your iPhones. Okay. So, The Handmaid's Tale.
There you go.
It's starring Elizabeth Moss, who is best known for Mad Men. She played Peggy in Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
It also has Alexis Bledel, who's best known for Rory Gilmore from Gilmore Girls and everything like that. And so what it is, it's a dystopian tale based on a novel written by Margaret Atwood. And it's about a religious, I can't religious. It's not like, it's like it's past tense. I'm just adding all these past tense, all these words. It's about a it's a fictitious religious fascist regime. That is hard to say.
Yeah, it's a lot.
In America. Mm-hmm. And it takes place in quote unquote present day. Like they're like when they have flashbacks, they're talking about Uber and. I guess that's only that might be the only.
Well, it's just, you can tell it's like present day modern.
Yeah, they have iPhones, mm-hmm. you know, and everything like that, and so the story, like it has this juxtaposition of the quote unquote near future and modern day. So the near future is the fascist regime has taken over, and the flashbacks that we get is the fascist regime trying to take over.
Right. It's kind of like on the verge of it yeah. all happening.
Actually, if you think about it, it's kind of, there's a little bit of three storylines going on, at least right now in the first four episodes, where it's like troubles brewing, you know, in America. Mm-hmm. And then there's the fascist regime has taken over, but Elizabeth Moss's character is in a quote unquote red center.
Yeah.
For her re-education.
Right.
And then she gets a position at a commander's house, and that's quote-unquote present day, and like the near future. That's right, the main storyline, right,
the main one.
And so yeah, it's dystopian, it's crazy, it deals with a lot of it's basically religious extremism. Like we see this stuff happening in other countries, mm-hmm. we've seen it in history, we see it going on right now, but it hasn't happened in America. This is what it would look like if a religious extremism of I think Protestant Christianity takes like just goes crazy, like someone who doesn't actually know what it what the religion stands for is and just takes it to its crazy degree, like it has in other religions and other areas of the world, and it is the most anti-feminist world you've ever seen. Like basically, yeah, it's a nightmare for women.
Right.
And that's the main focus of the show.
Yeah.
And so, like, we're not going to spoil anything for you because we're only four episodes in and we don't want to ruin anything. So right out of the gate, what did you think? Like, what did you think of the concept? Why were you hesitant of watching it? And what did you think after the first episode?
Well, I think that after the first episode, I think that I was interested. I was intrigued about what was going on. And this concept of like I told you, I was like, I want to know how they got to this point, like how did women become in this type of role, like where mm-hmm. You know, their main purpose is to have children and you know, work is not a part of it and everything like that. And I feel like a lot of the story actually comes out in the second episode, so
yes.
If you're kind of hesitant in the first episode, then go to the second one, because a lot of the dystopian factor of, you know, comes out of like the story of a little bit more about like why you should care.
Yeah. It's true.
So I feel like by I don't think we even questioned whether we're going to go for the third or fourth episode, just because I think we were kind of hooked by that point. It's not like the best thing ever. I'm sure some people are going to be like singing his praises. I feel like there's some time that's wasted a little bit. And if you've listened to this podcast at all, you know that we're not fans of that. But I feel like the character building is pretty good.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I think you're spot on about episode one. Like if you're on the fence after watching episode one, watch episode two.
Mm-hmm.
If you still don't like it after episode two, then it's
probably not for you.
Yeah it's probably not for
and
you.
Then you know, there's some weird stuff with it, so you have to, you know, it's rated mature for a reason, and you know, it definitely, there's a purpose to it. It's mm-hmm. to emphasize the role of women, of, you know, how they are. Yeah, absolutely. And but I feel like if you're like, oh, this is a little too weird for me, then don't give it a shot. But I think that if you give one and two a shot, then you can either decide whether you keep going or not.
I like what you said about how it's rated M for mature for a reason. That is true. But I also think it's not gratuitous.
That's true.
I really do. I know it's it's by your own definition. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
But nothing is done to titillate. Nothing is done to gross you out. It's this stuff happens, and so they show it to you. But even then, they do a good job of not showing everything that they
possibly
could.
Right, they're not showing extreme nudity or anything like that.
Yeah. And even the sexual situations, which in a normal situation would be very graphic, in this situation, you have to see what's going on in order to get the story.
Right. It's a huge plot point.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. And that's what you and I have talked about on the show before, is that we don't like vulgarity. We don't like anything that's gratuitous. But if it serves a plot, then we're fine with, like, with Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they don't need all that nudity, but it's a part of the plot about how they're subhuman. They're, like, not even human, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, okay, well, it goes towards a plot so we can get over it. With The Handmaid's Tale, that's that same thing, is that... And we're not going to ruin anything for you that's not in the trailer, but these people are basically forced surrogates.
Right.
But they don't use science.
No. Which, there's some things I'm like, why wouldn't you use, you know? Well, but I guess it probably goes to the Protestant, like, religious aspect of it.
The extremism.
Right.
Of like, you can't even call these people Protestant. I know that I use that word.
It's almost like a... Because, you know, they dress, like, you know, up to their, you know, to their necks. And, you know, everyone wears, like, long clothes. And it's almost like they've gone backwards, you know, as far as, you know, even fashion is, it's, like, futuristic, but also kind of, like, I don't know how I'm trying to say, but, like almost, like,
I know what you mean, like, it's they've gone backwards
extreme.
In their fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the type of fashion that you would see, like, it's what we're trying to say is it gives you that old world feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the religious fanaticism,
right,
and because of the religious order. But it takes place in the near future.
Yeah.
And that's the
feeling.
What did
we talk about? We talked about how it's like The Village meets V for Vendetta.
Oh, no, I said it's Children of Men meets V for
Vendetta.
Okay,
well, then add in The Village.
And then, yeah. It's a Children of... And that's the storyline that we didn't talk about. Apparently, the birth rate has just gone way down and they don't know why. And so we're just seeing a small section of this regime. And Elizabeth Moss's character is fertile, which is rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so she becomes breeding stock.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets placed with a commander's family, a commander in the army, whatever fascist army that they have or position. I don't know if he's like a... Yeah, we're not really sure if he's in the armed forces or if they're just calling him a commander because he's a political figure. I don't know.
Right.
But him and his wife can't have a baby. And so they... send in Elizabeth Moss's character, and so she is their forced surrogate, and so he rapes her. I mean, like, it's against her will, but it's not violent. It's
right.
Subservient.
Right. It's like, this is my job.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like she wants to, but it's so weird. That's where it gets a little.
And that's where it gets weird. That's where it gets graphic.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
And if what I just described you is more than what you can handle, then don't watch the show.
Right.
And the wife is actually in the room, holding the arms of the woman.
Well, they use the Bible verse about, like, Leah and Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Rachel couldn't have children, so she gave Leah to Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and it was it's interesting because they do use a lot of Bible verses. And since we're religious.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
and Protestant.
Exactly. It's interesting because... even Elizabeth Moss's character will say, like, yeah, they didn't finish that verse.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, blessed are the meek. Well, there's more to that verse,
yeah.
You know, where...
She says they never mention they'll inherit the
earth. Exactly. So it's just interesting to, since we're aware of these verses that they're mm-hmm. using in a negative light, you know, they're using to... uses like to make people into servitude or like to justify it. It's just an interesting way that you can tell that anything can be used for evil,
right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I think that's spot on, and that's the thing. So like people going into it, it showcases religion in a negative light.
It does.
Because it's religious extremism.
Right.
That's what it is. Because Elizabeth Moss's character even quotes scripture back to the extremists to fight their ideology. And they don't like what she's saying, even though she's quoting the Bible.
Exactly.
And so even though, like, you know, you and me, the girl and Tristan, are Protestants and believers, we're able to watch this because we can understand that this is extremism.
Right.
This isn't right. This isn't proper. This isn't righteous.
Right. These people aren't.
They're not true to the faith. They're true to themselves, and they use faith as a weapon.
Exactly.
And so if you can't handle that, then don't watch it. But after the first episode, I didn't really dig on it because, like you said, they didn't have any world building in the first episode.
It's just kind of, this is the way it is.
Yeah, and that bothered me. And so, but then once we got to the second episode, I was like, oh, okay. Because to me, the point of dystopian fiction are planting seeds of the revolution. And there was none of that. There was no revolution, no sight of any kind of resistance or hope in the first episode. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to like this. But I started getting into it in the second episode.
And like I said, I was like, well, it looks like what they're going to do is through the entire series, which is what they're doing, is they're basically showing you how this became this way.
Yeah.
Like, how did this world get to this point where we are in the near future? So,
and it's terrifying because the stuff that they're showing us has happened before.
Yeah.
And is happening right now.
It's true.
In other countries. And
it's true. Well, in some, in our own country.
In some of it in our own country. Yeah. So. And that's the terrifying part. And so everyone, like, there's a reason why everybody's talking about this show.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Everybody's talking about this
show. It's like a warning. I mean, it really is. And I think it probably came out at the right time because there's a lot going on that people are not happy with. And, you know, and it you can just see how one thing leads to another and then you lose control. Like, it's just, it's interesting to watch.
It's true. And so with this, like, for people who are, you know, like, who are concerned about, like, how they're portraying certain people with certain ideologies, any extremism is bad. I mean, this is like, if you're lean towards the right, it, you know, like the extreme example is fascism, which this show showcases. If you lean to the left, the extremism is communism, which this show does not illustrate. Both sides, millions die. It doesn't matter what your ideology is.
Right.
If it's too far, if it's extreme, people die, and minorities and women just fall to the wayside. So this is just one section of extremism.
Right.
But yeah, so we're going to keep going. I didn't really connect with the show until, and I'm not going to talk about it until Alexis Bledel's character, until that situation happened to her.
Okay.
I didn't connect with the show until that happened. I almost cried.
Yeah.
During that scene.
Yeah. It was rough. And it was really rough.
It was very rough. And there's two scenes involving her character.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, this is a powerful show. It's not the best show. It's not the greatest thing ever. But the message is there, and it's interesting.
Yeah, and I think it's worth, if you can get past some of the, you know, weird,
uncomfortable.
It's more uncomfortable than anything.
Yeah.
I think that it's worth your time.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Well, how about we move on to lighter things?
Yeah. And we move like on music.
To, like music. Everybody loves music. And so we're going to talk movie scores.
Yeah.
And it's hard for me because I'm trying to figure out, like, which one should I start with, and I'm thinking about making you start with one.
Okay.
So doesn't, no particular order. It doesn't have to be like, oh, right at the top of my list is this one. What's the first one we want to talk about? Because this is something that, where the music score, sometimes you can separate them. And they sound amazing on their own with no context. Other times you need the visual cues.
That's true.
And sometimes I think that's the thing with me, is that when I hear a movie score, it mainly links me to that scene. And I know that's the case for most people. I understand that. I'm not saying like I'm different. I'm just saying for me that's the case, because I know some people who will listen to scores before they even see the movie and say like, oh, like it'll be released on Spotify before the movie comes out, and they'll listen to the score before they watch the movie, and they're just like, oh, that's amazing. I can never do that.
Okay. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of links between images and the music. I think that obviously, like, that's the point of the score.
Right.
But I think that there, when I thought of, like, movie scores, the first one that came to my head was John Williams' Jurassic Park music score, because I feel like that one is the one that always sticks out in my head as, like, just so gorgeous. But I also have those images of, like, seeing the dinosaurs for the first time. So,
oh, okay. So is that the music that pops in your head when he sees, when Dr. Grant sees the dinosaurs for the first time?
Yeah, where we're on the Jeep ride. So I feel like that one, I know it just sounds funny, but, like, that's the one that pops in my head when I think about music.
No, that's not, that's not funny.
In movies, yeah. And I think a lot of it is the link, but I think that that score is gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
From a musical standpoint, so I feel like that one stands out in my head. But I feel like that one is very popular.
But it's popular for a reason.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing. And that moment is, like, when you think Jurassic Park, that's usually the moment that pops up into your head.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, like, when I think Jurassic Park, I think them seeing the dinosaurs for the first time.
Yeah.
Because it's when
everything's happy. And
yeah, it's when it's when the park director comes out and says, "Welcome to Jurassic Park."
Yeah, it's like full of wonder. And
Yes. See, that's a key word, wonder. Yeah. Wonder. It's filled with wonder, and that's what good movies do. That's what good sci-fi movies do, is they fill you with wonder, and the music can elevate that.
Yeah.
I feel like music is the thing that helps replace us not being there. Like, not physically being there, you know,
it makes you feel like you're a part of it.
Yes.
Because you're feeling the music.
Right. Exactly. All right. So with mine, I don't have any John Williams on here.
No, I put down Star Wars just because I felt like, you know, it's not my favorite score, but I think it has to do with the memories of seeing it. And
you're talking about Star Wars 77?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, let's talk about that since you brought it up. So what about Star Wars? Like, what makes you...
Well, okay, so like when I made this list, I was thinking about music that I would like put on my phone and listen to. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Star Wars would be one of them. I think it would just be like 77. But I feel like I have to add it to my list just because of the nostalgia and it... Again, the images that pop in my head when I hear it.
I'd have to agree with you that it's Star Wars, specifically 77. That score it's on another level.
Right.
With even somebody who is not a hardcore music fan or a hardcore sci-fi fan, they know that music.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the opening crawl music or Leia's theme or... Right. In like the medal ceremony,
right?
You know, it feels you are transported to those scenes. Every note that's hit, you think about Chewie, you think about Han, you think about R2, and you're just along for the ride,
right?
And it's one of those scores that really gets your heart pumping, but sounds classical at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if it would mean as much to someone who wasn't as into Star Wars, though. I don't know. I mean, it's still a beautiful piece of music. I think they would be able to acknowledge that. But I think when we just talked about it, I think that the images of the movie, that's what really drives these home.
Yeah. And that would be almost impossible to find a controlled sample group.
That's
of that, like, in the modern world, like what do you think of this song? You
know? Yeah, that's true.
All right, well, okay, so with my first one, I'm sure I've talked about this one before, actually. Now that I'm going over my list, I probably have talked about these before. But I'm gonna start, well, actually no, I'm gonna start with something that, when we were talking about evocative imagery, like, this one is, this music is so tied to a specific event for me that it's hard not to talk about. And that's First Night by Jerry Goldsmith.
Oh, really?
I love this movie. And I feel like I'm the only one. I have never talked about this movie with anybody else. Like, I've never been in a conversation where they're like, okay, so this one time, this happened in a movie called First Night, where Sean Connery and Richard Gere and Julia Armand were all hanging out. No one ever talks about it. No one acts like it ever existed. And I'm sure that there's huge fans out there, but I have yet to find them. And so there is, I'm going to spoil a lot in it. But okay, so it's the story of King Arthur. Richard Gere is Lancelot. Julia Armand is Guinevere. And Sean Connery is King Arthur, as the way as who he should be. And so with this moment, like, what happens is that we all know the story of King Arthur and Guinevere and all that business. You know, Lancelot and Guinevere are caught by kissing. And so, whoa, you know, they betray
the king. Forbid.
Yeah, they betray the king. And so they're put on trial, literally on trial in the public square. And King Arthur doesn't want this to happen. But anyway, and so right when that trial is going on, the big baddie brings his army and tries to sack Camelot. And so he has King Arthur under like bows, like crossbows and everything like that. And he says, he's like, if you don't kneel and submit to me, I'm going to burn Camelot down and I'm going to kill you. And he said, he's like, all right, fine. And he walks out, he pulls out Excalibur, and he's about to set it down, you know, in that gesture of surrender. And he says, he's like, I command you now, all of my subjects and everything like that. And right before he dips down his knee to surrender, he gets back up. And he flings the sword in the air. He's like, fight! I command you to fight! Never surrender! Never surrender! And then all of a sudden he gets like five arrows in the chest. And it just like the music starts swelling, and just like you hear this chorus just rising in the background, and then Guinevere screams, no! And then Lancelot picks up Excalibur and just starts hacking people away.
Wow. Are you okay?
It's an amazing scene. It's an amazing movie, and the music is just...
Wow.
It's just so great.
Oh my. Do you need like a break, or...?
I need a towel, because I'm sweating so much. But yeah, so that's one of my... Like, not only is that one of my favorite scores, I think it's one of my favorite musical moments.
Okay.
I think that's what a lot of these
yours are?
Mine okay. are my favorite musical moments.
Well, I guess Jurassic Park, that was a musical moment.
That's true. And you said Star Wars was a collection of moments.
I kind of did more, I don't know, scores in general.
Okay.
But, okay, like, I'll go for a calmer one.
Okay. All right. You don't want to reenact it like I did?
Forrest Gump. Theme with the feather.
Is that like by Alan Silvestri?
Yeah, so
the
feather part. Yeah,
the feather in the
yeah,
bench.
That score. Yeah,
no, that's a great.
I think it's
score.
A beautiful song, and you know, you're happy both times, like bittersweet, and I think it's the feather song.
The feather song.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is that like most people, when they think Forrest Gump, they don't really think about the score, they think about the soundtrack.
Oh yeah, it's a good soundtrack.
Because, I mean, any time you showcase a character a lot in the 60s and 70s,
right?
And
I mean, you can't
like
go
that,
wrong with that soundtrack.
Can't go wrong. I mean, it's basically a Tarantino film when you have that much 70s music. But yeah, that's and when you hear that music,
mm-hmm.
it's no mistaking where it's from.
Yeah.
And you feel like going and waiting for a bus while you listen to the music. At least I do.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'll do another one since yours was epic. I think one that has grown on me, which I didn't actually like at the beginning, but I know
exactly what you're going to say because it's on my
what
list.
What are you
going to
say?
No.
Is Interstellar by Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, that's
really?
Yeah, it's on my list too. And
actually hated it.
I was going to say the same exact thing.
I hated it when I first watched the movie.
Yeah.
And I thought it was distracting and in the way, and it's just like, oh, those just tones.
Way too robust for what
exactly.
it was.
Exactly. But now, like, it's just, I love that score. And if you didn't have a score with that movie, it just, something would be lacking. And I feel like that score is perfect for that movie.
Yeah, the first, it was, it's hard to think about because I like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
We like it more and more every single time we watch it.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And the music is tied to that. And I think because we didn't have such a deep connection with the movie the first time we watched it, we didn't really dig on the music. Also, I think there was something wrong with the theater presentation, which is really weird because it was an IMAX theater. So maybe it wasn't actually, a lot of people were reporting this. So I think that's just how the theater representation was, where the music was way too loud.
It wasn't balanced as well as it should have been. Yeah.
It was not balanced whatsoever. And so you could barely hear what certain people were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And the organs kind of hurt because they were so loud. And I felt like, oh, like this music doesn't feel like a sci-fi film. It doesn't feel like a Nolan film. And you know what? That's okay.
It almost feels like, I think maybe it's because it's the organ, but it almost, it feels like it's like a religious experience for me because I was used to the organ and like church.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like it doesn't have to be sci-fi. You know, when you think sci-fi, you think a certain type of music.
Mm-hmm.
But this is much more in the vein of like it's an experience than have to tie so much to the sci-fi element, I feel.
Yeah, and I think this had a very interesting genesis as well because Hans Zimmer wrote most of the music without reading the script.
Yeah.
And because what he just sat down with Christopher Nolan and they just talked about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that he didn't do is that he didn't say it's a father-daughter relationship. I think he just said
father-child
relationship. And so because he didn't want that to influence him in any particular way, he mm-hmm. wanted just that raw emotion, that raw connection to come out. And this is one of those scores where I hated it.
Yeah.
And now it's on this list.
Yeah.
Okay, but moving on, there's one that I've talked a little bit about before. Maybe not too much like some of the other ones on my list, but I have to talk about it because I just find that it's so much fun. It's so rhythmic, it's cool, and you don't think this name when you think movies or movie scores, but that's Tron Legacy's done by Daft Punk.
That is fun to listen to.
Right? I mean, we have the vinyl of it,
mm-hmm.
and we listen to it often.
Yeah.
And we just put it on the background, whether we're reading or playing with Ripley or whatever it is, and it just, I don't know why I listen to it while I'm reading, because it gets my heart going, and I start speeding if I'm driving to it. And
maybe you shouldn't, then.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't, but it's one of those things where this one isn't particularly tied to the moments of the movie. This one is really just, this is good, solid music. Like, even if there was no movie attached, mm-hmm. say that Daft Punk just released an album and
yeah.
they called it something else, I would still love this just as much.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's really good. Like you said, it has a lot of, like, you can't help but, like, have your heart start beating faster when you
yeah.
listen to it.
It's got driving beats and electric mm-hmm. feel, and it's a Daft Punk album.
Oh yeah.
And it even has like one that has a little bit more sullen aspect to it called Adagio for Tron. And that's one of those movies where I was jazzed watching it in the theater. And then, you know, after I thought about it, I was like, okay, well, that wasn't exactly what I expected. It didn't really live up to expectations, but I had a good movie-going experience. But then when I watched it on video a couple more times, it got better every single time
I
watched it.
It's
and
fun.
Same with the music, is that, like, I could make a playlist and drop any one of those tracks in, and it would be a better playlist.
Yeah, because I get that. Yeah. I completely get that. Yeah.
All right.
What's
next on your list?
Well,
I could keep going with epicness.
I like the pairing of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross a lot. And so, like, I'm thinking, like, Social Network and Gone Girl. Those scores are really awesome. And mm-hmm. definitely, like, when you think about it, sometimes I feel like when you think about a movie or you, like, look at our list of movies, the music doesn't stand out to you. But I feel like those two movies, they do in my head, maybe because I've seen them so many times, but especially Social Network, like, you can hear it immediately when I see the film's cover.
Yeah.
I can hear that sound. It's very, you know, iconic to that movie. So I think that there's something to that.
I think Social Network, out of all of modern Fincher,
yeah,
with Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor and everything like that as partners.
Yeah.
I feel like Social Network is the one that resonated the most with people.
Yes.
And there's a reason, because I'm pretty sure it won. Did it win the Oscar for?
I think possibly, yeah.
I can't remember. I think it might have. But yeah, that one, because even like right when the movie starts, like, and he's walking through campus of what's supposed to be Harvard, hear that, dun, dun, you know, just like that, that low tone and everything like that, which is, we listened to the DVD commentary of Social Network, and Fincher talks a lot about the music throughout the movie.
Oh, yeah. It definitely plays a part, I feel like, in his choices.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that when they did a cut of the movie, they sent that opening sequence to the pair, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and they threw in some like acoustic music underneath, and it was just it sounded like a college film, and the duo was just like, oh, this might not be the movie for us if this is what you're thinking about laying down. Like, we can't do this kind of music. And I know I'm paraphrasing, and I'm kind of dumbing down the situation. But I think Fincher said, just like, do what you would do. And so he threw down that track, because like what he did was, when he thought about the movie, the two of them developed like 5 tracks, without even seeing a cut. And then they threw down that one, and Fincher's like, boom, that's the tone of the movie. That's where we're going to go. And so in essence, I think, Fincher kind of implied that opening song that Ross and Reznor made helped dictate the rest of the movie when it came to editing.
Interesting. Yeah, the tone and everything.
Again, I am completely dumbing it down and paraphrasing, but that, like, Fincher said it much more elegantly than I did.
I think that there's a lot of pairings like that where the director and the composer work so hand in hand, because music is so important to the final product and what people come away with. And I mean, if you think of, you know, your famous new movie scores, they're so linked with the movie itself that it can't be helped. Yeah. Isn't there a documentary coming out soon?
There is. Yes, there is.
It's called Scores or something like that.
Something like that. I think it's called something simplistic like Scores, where it's I think they interview a lot of some of the great movie composers, and they talk about some of their favorite movie scores, not necessarily their own. And I don't know if it's coming to HBO or if it's just a wide release or not, but it looks really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's something to check out.
Yeah, I think you and I were just like, okay, yeah, we're gonna see that one. Okay. Yeah. We have the Gone Girl vinyl, and I don't know if I looked for the Social Network vinyl. I don't know if the one's made, but they have a Girl with a Dragon Tattoo vinyl, and it's like it was this ultra super duper limited release, and it was like, I think it was 2 or 3 records, double sided, and it came with like extra art and everything like that. And if you want it now, it's $350. And as much as we love Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, I thought about it. I did.
I know you did. I have to admit, you think about it often, I'm sure.
I do. I think about it a lot, but not enough to actually pull the trigger, because that is nonsense. Okay, so on my next one, this one is, this is the only superhero soundtrack that I have on here.
Okay.
And it's not Hans Zimmer's The Dark Knight, even though I want to talk about it. It's not. It's Danny Elfman's Batman.
Okay.
From 1989. This one, his opening theme of Batman's theme in 89, done by Danny Elfman, is how do I put this? It is more ingrained in my brain than the Superman theme could ever be.
Okay.
From the 70s. Now, the Superman theme is a great theme, and I think it's much more widely culturally known than Batman's theme in 89. But I...
Just because of who you are.
I think that's it. I think it's just because of who I am, and I'm a much bigger Batman fan than Superman fan, and I was a much bigger fan of that movie than the Superman movies in the 70s. And just that music, Elfman's music through the entire movie in conjunction with Prince,
you know, is just so cool and so unique. And it I've never heard anything like it before or since. And I feel like it's so unique to its time that, like, you could not... You can't transport it to another movie like in 2017.
Right.
It just wouldn't work.
It's for that film.
It's for that film and for that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, yeah, I think that's the only superhero score that I would put on this list besides Hans Zimmer's Dark Knight. I don't know. I take it back immediately. there was, even though I thought Man of Steel was underwhelming, the score was not.
It was, yeah, that was a good score.
That was some good music. Like, when he, like, first started learning how to fly.
Okay,
never mind. I lied. I completely lied. There's, like, 3 superhero films I would put on this list. Okay.
There's probably more if you haven't thought about it.
I completely take it back. All right, what's next on your list?
Oh, I'm running out of them, honestly. Ooh. Yeah, do you have more?
I do.
Okay.
I have lots more. one that I'll briefly talk about this, and I won't go into length about it, is David Newman's Serenity. It's the opening theme of the show.
That's right.
So I don't need to play you any music for it. It's you hear it every single time you listen to this podcast, and I've talked about it before. It's so emotional, and it's one of those scores where I don't need to, like, I don't think you ever needed to watch the movie, where it's just a beautiful score. And I've mentioned this before, but one of the character's themes he composed on a warped piano. It was water damaged. And he thought that, oh, the character is a little off. She's mentally unstable. So why not make her theme on a piano that's a little off key? And the director, Joss Whedon, was just like, man, this guy gets it. And I always think about that when I listen to River's theme. So, yeah, that's on my list. And do you need me to keep going? Because
I basically have just one more. I try not to go too far because you can keep going and keep going. But when I was thinking about, like, a score that... I would, like, put on my phone to listen to, you're a laugh, but, Fantastic Mr. Fox, score.
Not the soundtrack.
Nope.
The score.
Alexandre Desplat, he did that, and I just think it's so fun and whimsical and just, like, it's kind of kiddie.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it. I think it's very, I think it's, like, puts you in a happy mood.
No, that's a very playful theme.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's very jaunty.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, playful, whimsical.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can't have a bad day while listening to that music.
No.
And
yeah.
You actually produced a stage version of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
And we snuck in. And we because I was like, you always do my music. I was like, sweetheart, you can't do the play without sneaking in the music, at least during intermission. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, it doesn't have to be during the show, but, you know, like, closing and intermission and everything like that. And so, like, I was just, when I saw all these actors running around in Fox costumes hearing that Desplat music, I was just like, oh, jeez, this is cool. This is fun.
Yeah. I think it's a random choice, but why not, right?
I'm excited for his next film. It's called Isle of Dogs, and it's a stop motion picture.
Yeah, that'll be exciting.
I know. I'm super excited about another Wes Anderson stop motion. Good choice. God, solid choice. I'm not laughing at you on that one. That's a good, solid choice. All right. Well, okay. So I'll end on this one. Well, I wanted to mention Sin City, because I always thought Sin City was such a great underrated score.
Yeah.
But it had, like, 3 different people who did the score, including Rodriguez himself. And I don't know which track is devoted to which person, so I thought it'd be too complicated to play or talk about or anything like that. But yeah, I thought Sin City, like, that opening theme, like, after the prologue when you see the title.
Okay.
Like, you can hear
it. Yeah, I can hear that.
You can hear it in your head, and...
The rest is a little hazy to me.
It is, but I think it's just... Because there's so much of that movie was dedicated to tone.
Yes.
The score helped evoke that tone, and I think it's underrated because so much emphasis was put on the visuals, mm-hmm. which, I mean, the visuals deserve your respect and your admiration because of what it did and how little they shot practically and how much was green screen, but yet it looks like a living comic book. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of people out there who say, like, oh, this looks like it was ripped from the pages. Nothing is like that compared to Sin City.
Right.
And so I just wanted to give a brief mention of that. So I will end with Last of the Mohicans. Mm. This has to be one of the greatest scores of all time. And it's by Trevor Jones and Randy Edelman. And I couldn't tell you what else they've done. I'm sure I could look it up. But off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you what else they've done. But this is one of the most emotional scores I've ever listened to that I could weep. Just listening to the music without the visuals, and then once I'm crying and then you turn on the visuals, I'm just doubled over sobbing, like the like the grieving my girlfriend just broke up with me kind of sobbing, you know, like the ugly crying. That's what happens to me when I watch this movie.
We don't watch it often, probably because of that.
Yeah, probably because of that. It's kind of like The Fountain. It's too emotional to watch. But
that's true.
You know, I could talk about the theme. Like the theme of the movie, where it's played throughout the movie, and it's just when you hear that, it's just a couple of notes, and then you're like, boom, that's Last of the Mohicans. But then there's also the chase at the end that is just the scene is mostly music, it's very little sound effects, even no mm-hmm. dialogue, and it's just the scene is driven by the music. It goes on for minutes and minutes, and that's very uncommon in film. For it to just go on, and the sole emphasis is the notes, and it's a great time. it touches my heart.
All right. Well, anything else?
I don't think so. Okay. I think that really all that else that I want to hear is from you guys.
Yeah.
I mean, like, because you guys have answered a lot of you answered the nerd question of the day, but we want to hear from you personally.
Absolutely.
You know what? What are some of your favorite soundtracks? And the more esoteric, the better. You know, mm-hmm. stuff that we haven't heard of, or stuff that like anybody can say Jaws. But what's your personal favorite? Like, it's not even what you think is the best or the most heralded as the best. It's what is your favorite? What's on your list?
Yeah.
And so what you can do is you can go to thenerdparty.com/contact, select Nerd Nuptial from the drop down menu, fill out the form. And then that'll drop us a note, or you can find us on Twitter @JoinNerdParty or on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. And please go to iTunes, check us out. If you like what we do, give us a review. And if you give us a 5-star review, we'll mention you on the show. Well, I love you.
I know.
I was asleep before. That's how we let it happen. When they slaughtered Congress, we didn't wake up. When they blamed terrorists and suspended the Constitution, we didn't wake up then either. Now I'm awake. My name is Alfred. I had another name.
Ladies, I have to let you go. It's the law now.
They needed to do it this way. All the bank accounts and the jobs all at the same time. You imagine the airports otherwise?
Run, run, run!
No, please, don't take her! No!
You girls will serve the leaders and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
There's an eye in your house.
We'll send you to the colonies. You'll be cleaning up toxic waste and then you'll die.
Tonight is a celebration of Gilead and of what we have achieved.
We only wanted to make the world better.
Better?
Better never means better for everyone.
I want to keep on living for her.
Remember your scripture. Blessed are the meek.
And blessed are those who suffer for the cause of righteousness.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.